very touchy, I guess.
Should I turn it on so that turns it off?
Slightly.
I don't know, it might have been over, but not.
Right, right.
Okay.
All right.
Are you guys ready?
Yes. I am ready. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right.
Oh. So many benefits that I can get out of that when I can put something like a data portion of my database on solid state, especially when I can't control the application. I mean, I won't name products or anything, but when there's an environment that has a lot of fragmentation, one of the things that I can do to minimize that is look at the hardware and try to kill the problem that I am. So I definitely recommend looking at these things to, especially for third-party products, solve problems, but it's not just that. It's doing a way sometimes to solve a problem without a complex architectural change. So I'll let them tell you all about solid state and some of the tools that SQL Sentry has to analyze it. And we're just really excited to have these guys here because I think there's a lot you can do with their products. So thanks, Kevin.
Thank you. Thanks, Kimberly. Wow. Thanks, everybody. I appreciate you taking some time out to spend it with us. I want you to know that Sumeet and I are both consummately aware that we are all that stands between you and alcohol. So we need to get out of the way pretty quick, right? So we're going to talk about high performance and high availability on SQL Server 2012 with an eye towards always on. And so we wanted to introduce ourselves and tell you a little bit about ourselves. Now, we're actually partner vendors and we work together a lot, but we thought it'd be fun to bring this out in the context of one of our customers, actually. So we thought, well, that's a good way to tell a story without actually bogging it all down with facts and details. We're going to give you lots of facts and details, but let's give it a framework as well.
Kevin, where is the Rocky music?
Yeah. We're going to duke it out here in just a minute. Can everybody hear us in the back? Sound good? So Sumeet, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, sure. Apart from the fact that my name is Sumeet Bansal. All right. Yes, I work for this great company called Fusion.io, and I work with databases. I love databases, and I like them simple and fast. Good enough?
That's great. And my name is Kevin Klein. I'm at SQL Sentry. I've been in the SQL business for a long time. You might have heard of SQL Pass, a professional association for SQL Server. I was one of the founders of that organization. And I write books. SQL in a Nutshell is one of my books. And it's good to see a lot of friends here. I see some faces that I recognize. So thanks for coming today. So what we're talking about is a big customer. We have got a big customer that is doing a lot of work. So imagine you work for a big customer. You ever had a great technology rollout that maybe was as much about politics and getting along with another team as it was any other aspect of the whole process? We thought, why don't we frame it in that context? Sumeet, working on Fusion.io? Perhaps. Maybe he's working just on storage. He's our hardware guy. Then we've got the software guy over here, this gentleman here on the right hand, just to my right. So we have these two different people, two different sets of problems, looking at the whole situation that the customer requires some solutions to from two different perspectives.
So by the way, this is a template for how people dress. This is how storage guys dress. That's how software guys dress.
So we've got a real customer. We're not going to name any names, but this is a major financial institution, one of the top three financial institutions in the world, headquartered in London. And they have a really important core application that they came to both of us to discuss.
It's not me, is it? All right.
It's not either of us.
Oh, okay. Because I'm trying not to move.
Hey, Macarena. Okay, and so it's the processing credit cards, transactions, lots of them. On that third bullet, 10,000 transactions per second. Now, what's the difference between a transaction and an IOP? They're not the same thing, are they? A SQL transaction, it's going to be just one IOP? I hope you're saying no, right? But I used to do a lot of TCP testing, TCP benchmarks, And back in the late 90s, which is totally applicable today, right? Back in the late 90s, last time I did some really hardcore testing, it was about 16 to 1. That was my rule of thumb back then. If I saw somebody say, I'm going to do 10,000 transactions, I think I'm going to hold this in my hand. Maybe that will help. That meant a 16-fold increase in the number of IOPS. This was a huge, huge rollout, huge server,
huge investment, enormous amount of man hours spent on it. And then they needed all of that to stay up and running as well with always on. So that was going to be the high availability solution. And just to give you
an idea of what this server, what this workload looked like, have you ever seen a task manager that looked like this? Anyone? Sorry? We got a new mic. That's your laptop, right? Yeah. So, pretty busy environment. A lot of activity going on that main server. And we learned some really interesting lessons that might surprise you. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of these lessons learned when you're shooting for very, very high performance systems.
No, Kevin, I'm sorry, but I have to make sure that you're qualified to give this presentation. Oh. Can you tell me how many total cores there are?
Okay. we've got 16 down and 16 across. 2, 4, 6.
There has to be a faster way.
Yeah, there has to be a faster way. I'm going to say 256.
Excellent. Good. We can move on. Excellent, Kevin. Thank you.
Oh, there's another way now that I think of it. He's double-checking all my math here. 32 8-core processor, right? So 256, either way you get it, right? Wow, that's a big system. So meeting the customer requirements.
Right. So big customer, a lot of infrastructure, they want performance. How do we go about it? Too many damn things to keep track of. OS, SQL, processor, your NIC cards, your arrays, your storage arrays. You really can't focus on one element of the infrastructure and say, well, I'm done. Because you may improve one component, but the other component may become your bottleneck, may hamstring you. And so you really have to go down the stack one by one, making sure that at every level, you're driving the performance that your customer needs. So all in all, a pretty hairy problem to solve.
So if you're saying, we're just going to throw hard disks at this?
Not good.
That's going to fix it?
You can buy 1,000 hard drives, but then what if your HBA is not good enough?
Oh, well, what if we buy a bunch of HBAs?
Well, maybe your NIC card sucks.
Well, what if we get a bunch of NICs, too?
Well, I don't know. Something will fall.
Okay. Yeah.
Too many components.
Each time. So we have a multiplicity of opportunities to screw ourselves up, huh?
Exactly.
Okay.
This, although one can make it work, but it is a terrible architecture. Too many things
right.
that can fail and fall apart.
Yeah. Complexity at every turn. Well, when we started to build out these systems and started to do these huge scalability tests, we had some surprises. And the first surprise was that SQL Server actually does a pretty good job of memory in particular. It's like, what's SQL Server going to break on? And, well, it's top three things, right? CPU, and memory, and I.O. Well, first surprise was memory was pretty good by default. You didn't really have to do too much to it to get really good performance. But we also learned some things that there are opportunities for improvements in performance. The key, the essential takeaway about improving memory on these super high-end, super high-performance SQL Server systems was knowing the workload. So if you don't really know, if it's a packaged app that you bought and you're going to install it and run it, how well do you know that schema and that workload? If you're like me, you don't even know it really well, even if you've studied a lot, just because there's not much up here. But we don't know it, right? We bought it. We just want it to run. So it takes a lot of work to go from that 80% really effective to 98% really effective. But what it comes down to is a couple things in Windows rather than SQL Server. The first is lock pages in memory. Because we know our workload so well, we can make sure that SQL Server gets those dedicated pages in memory. And no one else can tamper with that. No other processes, no other jobs, no other things on SQL Server can mess with it. I'm sorry, on Windows can mess with that. And then the other thing is to use large page allocations. Now, this can also help a lot, but it's the kind of thing that you need to know that workload really, really well. If you try these things and you don't know your workload well, your performance gets worse instead of better, right? Another interesting thing, too, is that all of our servers now are pretty much NUMA. Right? Even whether we acknowledge it and set it up and configure it for all the switches to say that it's NUMA, non-uniform memory architecture, they are running that way in the background. And one of the interesting things about NUMA is that it works incredibly well, except in situations like on number 11 down there in the center bottom, in which we're crossing a NUMA node. So if we keep everything, all of that memory, all of that work that we're doing on that one NUMA node, dedicated to the NUMA node, we don't cross over and grab memory from other nodes, it works really, really well. But once we start to span those gaps and jump over.
How much memory are we looking at here?
Well, in my case, it's just zero. That's all I've got. How much memory are we looking at here?
Total pages. Can't be that hard to read.
Hmm?
Can't be that hard to read. So in other words, what we are saying here is that if you have tons of memory, if you have terabytes of memory in your server, then all is well, right? That's what we are saying.
So let's just reach deeper into our wallet and we'll solve that problem with throwing money at it.
All right, let's see.
Well, let's try it. Right?
Let's carry on.
Now, that's the first surprise. Memory is good. I was kind of surprised. I thought this was going to have to take a lot of tuning. The second surprise was NICs. Not the New York Knicks. Second surprise was the network interface cards. One of the things that was really shocking is how much work the TCP/IP generates, all of these different interrupts hitting CPUs throughout the system. And so they have to be handled by some core or other, right? And so there's a really interesting rule of thumb that has arisen for doing high-end systems that are, you know, processing thousands of users connecting simultaneously. And that is you need to set aside about one... For every 16 cores, you need to have a NIC. If they're all being fully utilized by lots and lots of users, you better set one aside. And the way you set aside your cores for those NICs to process is using SQL CPU affinity.
Right.
So you say, I'm going to take CPUs 1 through 4, and I'm going to say SQL Server, you can't have those 4. And it looks like this. I'm not sure if you can see that red line, and I'm red-green colorblind, so I can't see it at all, actually. But in the first 4 CPUs, you see there's a much higher utilization because those are all being dedicated to active user connections controlled through those NIC cards. And I just redundant myself again.
No, that's all right.
Okay. So the network interface cards were handling all that, those CPUs were handling all that network interface traffic on those first 4. And all the rest were actually going towards that SQL Server traffic that was piping through that system.
Kevin, can I say something?
Of course.
So this is a very cool trick, and especially you will have to use it, particularly if you're using 10 gig cards, 10 gig NICs. With 1 gig NICs, things more or less work by default, but with 10 gig NICs, if you don't do this, you might find that the NICs themselves end up overwhelming your servers, your SQL servers in particular.
I think with the 1 gig NICs, they're just a little too slow to actually saturate it
exactly.
That much. But when you hit that 10 gig level, now we can push that bottleneck one step further, just like we were talking about when we had that hierarchy of different objects in the system, from the OS to the SQL Server to the CPU and so forth. All right. Now, in this particular area...
Can I talk?
Yes, of course.
Yes. So we're going to look at a few things that typically one would like to look at when they are setting up a SQL Server. Now, this is what happens in an ordinary world. So number of files, very cool feature. If you can separate your database, and say if it's running on a single data file and you take it down to 4 data files or 8 data files, you may be pleasantly surprised. You may find that simply by doing that, you can increase the performance, the throughput of your SQL Server. Number of drives, yes, matter. The more drives you have, you can rate them and you get higher throughput, yes. But remember, by rating more drives, by creating large RAID sets, you're also introducing an element of failure because the number of components is increasing. Anytime you're setting up your SQL Server, especially for performance perspective, you need to understand the full topology of it. It's not just about storage, it's not about the memory, it's not about even the network connectivity that you have between your storage and your server. You really have to understand every single element to make sure that your performance is not getting cut in the foot at any one particular point. So the key thing here is try to validate your performance, do the performance benchmarking properly for all the components to understand that you're not investing unnecessarily in one area while the other area is handicapping you.
You know, I've heard that everything on the internet is true. And so I was wondering, why don't we, I've seen somewhere on the internet that says you create one file for each CPU you've got. Is that always true?
At some point I have to say I don't think that is true.
Uh-huh.
I don't think everything on the internet is true.
Oh.
Because I just read this blog which claimed that I have $5 million in my bank account. Now, I wish it were true, but it's not the case. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here presenting, right?
Just I would feel better about it.
No. I love this. This is what I love, so I would still be doing that. But what we have in front of us is something from, I would say, a very certified source.
Very certified.
I think people swear by what he writes. People swear by what he says. And especially when he's writing under the effects of alcohol.
Yes, so, I've heard that. I've heard that improves the.
So I can assure that this is good research data, and it clearly shows that by simply taking the same database, the same size, the same workload, but simply by going from one data file to 8 data files, we were able to drive significant performance improvement. Now, of course, as you were saying, you can make the number of files equal to the number of cores. Well, not really.
And, I think 256 cores might have been really good, right?
Yeah. You should try that and let me know how it goes. But at some point, you do get to a point where the number of files is too much and you start running into a point of diminishing returns.
So the overhead gets too much, is it?
Right.
Okay, what point
By the way,
is that?
If you can't read it, this was something done by a gentleman called Paul Randall.
Right.
I'm sure you know him.
I've heard of him.
Yes.
Oh,
hello,
he's
Paul.
Here?
Didn't know you were here.
So yeah, it looks like when we go from 4 files, 40 gigabytes each, to 8 files, we see a nice drop in the amount of time spent processing that workload. But then there's a point of diminishing return in there somewhere. When we go up to 16, it starts to go away. It starts to take longer. In fact, it takes longer than it did with 4 files. So definitely make sure you take some time and test your different configurations. Things like, where am I going to put tempdb? Where am I going to put the user database? Do I put them on the same disks? If they're on the same disks, maybe they're going to, compete with each other for those I/O resources.
Right. Now hold on to those standard best practices. Hopefully we can shoot them down. So some rules of thumb.
Okay.
Lot of data.
Start working on those right now.
Are you reading
right?
all of this? Because you have there will be a pop quiz at the end, and you will be asked for some of this data, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So here's the bottom line. When you're looking at the spinning disk, which is what most of the traditional storage is made of, what do we have in terms of performance? Let's break it down. I'm sorry. My devices are simply not turning off today. So, if you have a basic disk, what can it give you? So please excuse me, the terms full stroke and short stroke. They are legal technical terms. It is not my intention to introduce anything naughty in this presentation. So with full stroke, a single disk at the most can give you 130 IOPS. Now full stroking simply means you're utilizing the disk platter completely in its entirety. With short stroking, and again, nothing very naughty, you leave most of the platter empty and you use only part of the platter so that the mechanical arm that needs to move doesn't have to move too much. you can get up to 180 IOPS. I'm sure you can do something else, and you can take that 180 IOPS and turn it into 280 IOPS. But that is max. That is what you can get from a single disk. So what does that mean? If you really want high performance, is it as simple as just taking 1,000 of these spinning disks or 2,000 of these spinning disks, putting them together and driving performance?
It is.
No,
we shall
see about that.
It may not be. That's what my SAN admin said.
So but just to give you just to get you thinking, think about our customer. Think about our bank, right? They need terabytes of server, not just in terms of storage, but they need terabytes of storage that has very high performance. So does that mean for every terabyte of usable capacity, they need to materialize 50 terabytes or 60 terabytes or 70 terabytes of actual capacity? Those are the kind of questions that this metric leads us to.
Now, you had mentioned stroke, right? Like a rower maybe doing a full stroke or short stroke?
Well, no. I think you missed when I think your mind wandered off.
Okay.
You're going towards the dirty side of things.
But I'm talking about a rower here.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Now, that means we're going to be moving stuff back and forth, right?
Exactly.
And that means we always are kind of limited. We always have latency, right, as we move this stuff back and forth?
Absolutely.
We move these armatures around and all that sort of
Absolutely.
Thing?
Absolutely, because this is based on physical movement, and you can only accelerate physical movement so far. It's simple laws of physics. For example, even the platter is spinning. The speed, there is a reason why the speed has not crossed the threshold of 15,000 RPMs for so many years now. And that is because if you spin the disk really, really fast,
15,001 RPM?
Yes. Let me finish.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The disk will start losing data. The disk will start producing unnecessary heat, and the data won't be valid. There won't be any credibility. So the physical laws basically keep this from doing much better than what it can already. Right. So we can aggregate a lot of throughput by combining a lot of these I would say archaic things, but that is not the solution. And obviously, my colleague Kevin mentioned that because of this technology, there is not much we can do about the latency. It is what it is.
And it is always going to be at least 3 to 5 milliseconds, yeah?
If not more.
If not more, right. And the Microsoft best practice documents have their own recommendations about what's the right amount for a data file or a transaction log file.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the way, anybody knows what those standard best practices are? Kevin, do you know them?
Mm-hmm.
What is a good, like when do you say that your database is performing optimally? What's the threshold for, say, log file latency?
Log file latency, I like to be within a couple minutes. Maybe to the half-hour point, somewhere in there.
No. What's the real best
practice? Oh, okay.
What's the real guidance?
The real best practice for the transaction log should be about 10 milliseconds or less.
Really?
Yeah. That's what Microsoft says.
10 milliseconds. My God, that seems like ages.
Ages? That's pretty fast. I talk to customers all the time, calling our support help desk, and they're like, I need help getting this under 1,600 milliseconds.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, well, so we'll have to do something about that.
We'd be thrilled with 3 to 5 milliseconds.
Because I tell you that if we go to our customer and tell them that we have built a solution for them that is giving them a latency of 10 milliseconds on the transaction log file, we will not get that project.
Mm.
They will kick us out the door.
Hmm.
So we need to do better.
Wow.
Right.
All right.
So by the way, here, this is something that I'm sure you have all seen. And not to stretch the point further, but it is simply the spinning platter and the arm that needs to move back and forth that introduces the concept of latency into a disk and has very limited potential in terms of performance.
Mm. That's what all my Bee Gees vinyl looks like, just like that.
And then we are not done yet, obviously, because then you have your cables. You have to deal with, you know, what are the performance abilities and how much data they can transfer between them. You have to worry about where your product is, what's the bandwidth of your PCI bridges.
So if I bought 1,000 hard disks like my SAN vendor recommends me doing, you're saying I'm not actually going to be sure that I'm going to be able to get all those IOPS through that system.
No, because you need to worry about your HBAs, what are the capacities and limits of your HBAs. You need to worry about the cable between your server and your chassis. There's tons of different stuff that you need to worry about, because you can have performance on one side, but you may have a weak link in your environment. So this is a good graphical way to illustrate the point. So in the beginning, you can see, now go from left to right, you start with certain bit of hardware, and you see that, you see here, is my mouse hovering?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You see there is a plateau phase?
Right.
Well, just like any other good person, we do the easy bit, and we add one more disk. And our performance, our throughput goes up a little bit,
Gets better, expected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then it plateaus again. Then we add a controller, because we found that a controller, we don't have enough controllers. We do that, and we are happy for a while, and it plateaus again. And then finally, at some point, we realize that, you know what, we have done it. We can't do anything more to it, and we have hit whatever our black backplane will support. That is the performance that we can get in the end. Right.
So we threw lots of disks at it.
Right.
We hit that bottleneck.
But limited potential, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So won't make our bank very happy. And here it's a numerical measure of that. You can actually calculate the exact contribution of each component that you add to your infrastructure. So you know what, Kevin? I think we just put too many words in this PowerPoint presentation.
Maybe so.
I think I've said it already.
Yeah.
But understand your topology. That's the message that I'm trying to put here. The more complex your topology, the more work you will have to do if you want to drive in the end the high performance out of it, because you will examine every single component in a topology. So for SQL Server storage, what are the two most common methods of materializing storage today? I would say one is direct attached storage, and the other one is storage area networks. Right?
Sure.
Now, are those the only two solutions? Well, let's see. But first, I'm going to ask my colleague Kevin to tell us a little bit more about what a DAS is and what a SAN is. Is that okay with you?
I thought you said a dance in SAN. Okay.
No, that comes,
a DAS.
No,
in
that
SAN.
Comes later.
All right.
After the event.
All right.
You're running. Oh, look.
Well.
No,
let's talk
me.
About this for a minute.
Right. So, look, pretty picture.
Less words.
You must have put that.
I thought when you said less words, I thought you meant more like more grunts, cavemen. Okay, more pictures.
All right. So this is what a typical architecture looks like, right? And let's trace the path of data as it makes its way through the various components, through the entire topology, into the server, to the processor, to the memory,
Okay. Where
it's useful. So it starts at the spinning disks or even your run-of-the-mill SSDs, has to pass through RAID controllers. A lot of these chassis, the vendors want to make it smarter, so they add their own processors, they add their own memories, thinking, oh, wow, if we are not going to consume host resources, it will have a it's almost like to a point of boasting. Oh, do you know that my chassis has half a terabyte of RAM?
That's right, okay.
Or do you know that my chassis has a dedicated processor?
Right, okay.
But in the end, it is an extra component, and it is, in fact, slowing things down.
Sure.
From there on, the data has to make its way through the target adapters. It has to navigate the sea, the ocean of networks, through the switches, HBAs. And then finally, it ends up in memory.
And that whole round trip can take seconds.
Well, milliseconds.
Milliseconds.
Let's be generous. And so this whole concept is latency. Think about this data path in the context of just one data request. This is the same path that every single data request has to traverse. And that is where the concept of latency comes in. Every time data is requested on the server, this whole cycle has to be completed. Now let's look at what are some of the cool stuff, some of the stuff that our bank needed. How do we make that faster, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are some new emerging technologies that we will talk about in a bit. And what they do is they allow you to completely eliminate the need of this whole latency-based section. And what you do, actually, is you put your storage, persistent storage, very fast storage, right on the PCIe slots, PCIe subsystem of your server. That way, it is sitting right next to your processors, right next to your memory, and therefore, when application demands the data, it is there. And the difference is that now your latency is on a microsecond scale. Microsecond, millisecond. Immediate 1,000 times improvement.
And let's go back to that for just a second. Let me ask you a question here. When we looked at the other slide, we saw all kinds of different steps throughout. And I remember one thing that we see over and over again is that thing called a HBA. And it seems like half of the problems that we get are fixed by updating the firmware in the HBA. So am I seeing this right? Or do we not even have that anymore? We're done with all that, aren't we?
Yes, Kevin. The reason why this section is in white is to show that we are not using it anymore.
Okay, all right.
And that's why the loop closes here for the microsecond.
I get it.
All right. Access latency.
You know, I like to joke with a lot of my friends who work in the big enterprises, and they have a SAN team that does a lot of very useful and important work inside of the company. And one of the things that the SAN admins try to tell the database or the application people is that the SAN is the panacea. It's the cure-all to all of your problems, your performance problems. We'll fix all of your performance problems. And so we started to look at it. We started to look at what the workloads look like, you know, and here's, so green is the checkpoint processes, as it happens every so often inside of the SQL Server, flushes all those dirty pages out to disk, and we've got the transactions per second up at the top, and we've got the disk latency in black. You know, and it naturally just peaks up and when there's a checkpoint happening. And it's like, yeah, this is the cure to all of our stuff, you know, all of our problems. Why don't we just throw more, you know, just a bunch of disks, throw more disks at it, you know. In fact, don't even configure it. Don't even spend time working with the files and file groups and, you know, where are we going to put things. Just put it all in one gigantic LUN, you know, on this SAN, and we'll fix everything for you. And I said, that is awesome. That's what I want to do because I want really consistent, reliable performance, right? And then when I turn around and say, oh, look at how reliable my performance is, it's like, oh, well, oh, wait a minute. Sorry, we were... Maybe...
That looks reliable, Kevin.
Sorry?
That looks very reliable.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. I sometimes joke that the storage area network is now, instead of the panacea to all my problems, it is the central location of all of my problems. I'm being harsh. Yeah, you know, it's the SAN actually wasn't even really conceived to be super high performance. It was conceived to be a cost and consolidation saving maneuver, right? So we're not trying to save, we're not trying to make maximum performance, we're trying to make this scale out so that lots of machines, lots of boxes can take advantage of that SAN at one time.
So Kevin, does that mean that when the bank asks for high performance, we just tell them that, but you know what, the SAN wasn't designed for high performance, so you can't have it?
Well,
is that what we need to say?
We don't need to say that. We can make a SAN perform really well. We just have to throw a lot of energy and a lot of resources at it to make that happen.
Yes, nice consulting dollars for me.
Yeah. All right, let's start billing for that. You know, and so when we're talking with so many of our customers, we're in a situation where we're like, okay, I've got direct attached storage. A lot of the different research that we've done out there shows that it's a little bit faster, it's a little bit easier to set up and configure. That's nice, but it has a high end in which it caps out. We can't do any more with it. We can't expand it anymore. We can't make it bigger. It's not as flexible as the SAN on the other side. We can do so much with it, and we can put so many disks in there, and it can have so much cache, and it does have these CPUs in it to help change that workload. And it's like, well, you know, which of those should I do? Maybe I should go with the more flexibility, even though it costs a lot and there's more opportunities to, you know, mess things up. You know, it's like the old flow chart, you know, which I could do, I'll do the SAN. That's going to be the best. Well, you know, that's not really the requirement, though, because the requirement was optimal performance.
Right.
And the very best performance I could get would be in DAS. So what is, you know, what is the best solution to this?
How about manageability for DAS?
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, right. Got to open that case up.
So, Kevin, let me make it easy for you. That is actually a trick question. The answer is neither SAN nor DAS. It is something else. Can you please click the button on your clicker? Oh, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah.
That is the solution. Now, what is it? Well, I don't know if you can read it, but the word says IO Drive Duo. It's a fantastic new technology. But before I tell you more about it, oh, there you go. It looks nice, doesn't it? Looks like Porsche designed it. But before I tell you what it is, I want to tell you what it makes possible.
So this is like a commodity thing I go down and pick up? And
hey, you know, you can buy it from Dell, IBM, HP.
Oh.
In fact, don't tell anyone. You can probably pick one from eBay. you can get it from anywhere.
So you're saying this is going to be superior. What can this thing do?
All right. So imagine, first of all, so please raise your hand if you like Austin Power movies. Groovy. So imagine they were making a new Austin Powers movie, and this villain decided to take over the world by taking over the entire credit card processing of the world. What would he need? So let's see. He would need one part SQL Server. He would need four I/O drives, depending on, you know, when he's acquiring them. And that is all he would need.
To simply do all the credit card?
So let me put it in numbers.
Okay.
Right? So just by taking one SQL Server, having four I/O drives, he will be able to process over 12 billion transactions per day.
That's about what my ex-wife would do on her credit cards in a single day, actually, now that you mention it. 25 billion is the number I'm looking at here.
Right.
25 billion transactions in a day.
So if you can control all of that with one SQL Server, can you imagine what else you can do with one SQL Server that is running on I/O memory?
So with the customer that we were talking about just a little while ago, they needed 10,000. What was that, 10,000 a minute?
Right.
So this is easily within, this is just a, that's just a tiny fraction of what we're asking for here.
Exactly. So that is what it can do. And
let's switch over and take a look at that.
As opposed to just words, let me also show you some workloads that we are running.
Let's see here. And I'm going to pull both of these up. Did you want to see both of the transaction workloads?
Right. So this is the workload. Now, this is a workload, this is a TPCC workload, because the idea was I did not want to bore you with disk-level metrics like IOPS, throughput, latency. IOPS and throughput, they can be gained, and the problem is, even if you know what the IOPS and throughput profile your equipment is capable of, it is very hard to translate that into what your application can actually use. So we are actually running a TPCC workload to simulate an application. A real application, a transactional application that, say, an e-commerce vendor would use. This workload that you're seeing in front of you, it is being run on a commodity SSD. I'm not going to mention any names because this is not a competition, but it is one of your run-of-mill SSDs, and we are generating about, I would say, 800,000 transactions per minute. But look at the graph. It's not very consistent. It has you know, big dips in there.
Up and down.
Right. Now let's switch over to, oh look, the performance just dropped there. Can you go back there? There you go.
Yep, it's going downward.
So it's not very consistent. You get your performance to a certain level, but then you don't know when it's going to fall off.
Right.
So let's show them the second workload.
And I'm going to make this one small. It's kind of one of these screen size things here.
Ah. So that was about 800,000 transactions per minute. Here, what you're looking at is the same workload, same application, but running on a single I/O drive. And you are getting, you know, roughly, I mean, it has its ups and downs, but it is pretty much, if you average it out, you're looking at 2.5 million plus transactions per minute. So that is, what, 3 or 4 times faster, roughly?
Yeah.
So it's very interesting to note, because a lot of times when people talk about Fusion I/O technology, because Fusion I/O technology is also based on NAND flash, as is your run-of-the-mill SSDs. So a lot of people have these questions. So what's the difference? Why would I get your product and not just some SSD? Well, this is why you would not get the SSD.
And this doesn't even bring into the picture, let's say, a RAID 5 array with 5 disks in it or something like that.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Very good point, Kevin. So the other aspect of SSDs is that the densities are somewhat limited. So if you want to materialize a high-density database, then you have to resort to either a RAID controller, a hardware RAID controller, or you really have to put a lot of SSDs together to actually get the density that you want.
Right.
Whereas with I/O drive products, you know, you can have a single card that has 2.4 terabytes. You can have a single card that is even 10 terabytes.
Wow.
So imagine the performance density that you can materialize with the Fusion I/O solutions.
Mm. Right. Excellent. All right. Let me flip back to the presentation here. All right. So that was one whole side of the business. It was very difficult, very long struggle, lots of hard work to get things working as well as we did. But then we had the whole other set of requirements, two more sets of requirements. One was, now we got to be able to tell what's going on in this environment. You know, we've got this whole stack, all these different points at which things can break. Maybe we're not going to be able to get through. To see things, to the visibility, to the transparency, to the instrumentation that we have in this system. That's hard. That's not easy. Anyone here run your, don't raise your hand when I ask this question. Anyone here, you know, run your shop, do troubleshooting based on how much your telephone rings? That's like how I managed my IT infrastructure for several years until I realized I was doing it completely wrong, right? You have to actually know your problems and fix them before your customers do. Right? Because I don't know about you, but as a database person, there have been very few times in my life when I knew that the system was working really well, and I'm walking down the hallway, and my users are walking towards me, and they're like, high five, Kevin. Give us some skin, man. Things are so fast. You are awesome. It's like, no, it doesn't actually work that way. You know, on a good day, things are working well. There's no complaints. I'm walking along, and people are like, hey. You know. But when things go bad, who's the first person they want to talk to? Right? That was this guy. So it's like, you know what? I want to know these problems before they happen. I don't want my users to tell me about them. So we started to spend all this time trying to figure out how are we going to make sure that this is properly instrumented so that the DBAs and the business owners even, non-technical people, could take a look, take a glance, and know how well things are doing. And we thought, well, let's start with PerfMon. You know, there's the very, very common ways to monitor performance with PerfMon, things like IOPS, your throughput, your latency, all of those different values and numbers there, average disk per second reads, average disk per second writes. We have things like the disk reads and writes per second, disk bytes and so forth per second. It's really simple. It's really cut and dried. But the problem is, when we start to look at these in the tool, if you actually take a look at those PerfMon counters, there's hundreds and hundreds of them. And under each of those counters, there's dozens of objects, and which one means something, and which one doesn't mean anything, and which one means something only when another one has a number of a particular value greater than this number. And it's like, whoa, this is a lot of information. We got to figure this out. Well, maybe we won't use PerfMon. Maybe we'll use Profiler or SQL server-side traces. You know, what we'll do is we'll flip on Profiler. We'll watch all the different SQL statements as they occur. They're triggered and they happen. We'll watch those scroll by on the screen. Well, it was on the last release that Microsoft, for the relational engine, said, we're not going to keep doing that for very long. Now, on analysis services, they still do use Profiler. Well, you know, it's the kind of thing that it's not a reliable long-term solution because we don't know how long Microsoft wants us to use that part of it. So we could get good value out of this, but again, we're going to see individual SQL statements. We're not going to see the big roll-up, the big picture of everything that's happening. So we've got two views into this. And then we could go one more step. Well, why don't we start looking at these dynamic management views? And there's some great dynamic management view queries. You can see I used right here some queries written by Glenn Berry, who's with SQL Skills. And so he's written a lot of really, really good DMV queries, so we can find out how much of the buffer cache is used or what are the biggest objects in the buffer cache and things like that.
So, Kevin.
Yes.
So all of this is good info. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, you know, our customer, the bank, they have DBAs.
Mm-hmm.
They probably know this, or you know, they're probably reading Paul's blog or your
mm-hmm.
blog or
yeah,
somebody else's blog, and they know all of that. But they're looking for something different. You know, they want to do something that's easy, that's quick.
Mm-hmm.
They want to move away from tracking all of this thing, all of this stuff in five different ways.
Oh, well, they weren't even done here. The next thing they started to look at was, well, maybe since the profiler's going away, what's supposed to be the new thing that we're going to use? What are we going to use instead of profiler? Server-side traces. And it's this really cool new thing called extended events. And it can tell us lots of things about, you know, how much of any particular resource is being used. But again, it's the kind of thing that we have to research, we have to learn, we have to set it up, we have to script it out, we have to maintain it. And every time there's a new service pack or a new cumulative update, maybe we've got to change all these things. So even though there is some interfaces in there, there's not a very rich or intuitive interface to take advantage of these extended events. And then once we have figured out all of the ways to use the tooling inside of SQL Server, okay, we've got all that figured out. Now how do we go to that step I mentioned a while ago where we make sure these systems tell us when they are going bad before the users call us up and tell us, right? So we need to know a little bit about notifying us, giving us an alarm when there's a problem. And there's good news there. There is a free facility inside of SQL Server, inside the SQL Server agent called Alerts. And we could go in there and we could set that up. We could go in and say, for all of the severity level errors of such and such a particular value or greater, we want to get an error message. Maybe when CPU is greater than a certain amount, we want an error message. I want to get an email for that, you know? Those are good things. But one of the problems that we experienced is, let's say, for example, our SQL Server ship starts to sink. What are we actually using right here to let us know that the ship is sinking? We're using SQL Server, right? So we're using SQL Server to monitor SQL Server and notify us when SQL Server is having a problem, which when any step along the way gets broken, the whole thing breaks. And we don't know until our customers are calling us again and telling us this thing is broken. So it's one of these kind of things where, what's the better way? So let me show you that. And that is with the SQL Sentry products here. So on these different servers where we were running these workloads, these high-level workloads, we can look at any period of time that we are interested in. I apologize, it scrolls off the screen quite a bit here. Let's, I was thinking maybe I could maximize that. But we can look at, on the left-hand side, all of the Windows activity on this server. So the left-hand side is all Windows. You can see there's a great big spike right here on this particular time frame. On the right-hand side is all SQL Server. So we can correlate, just at a glance, this Windows spike in disk activity. And this is the milliseconds to perform a read, milliseconds to perform a write. You can see that's going upward. And then we can correlate that to what's happening inside a SQL Server on the right-hand side. So you can see that the wait stats do indeed jump up quite a bit. If we hover over this, it'll tell us exactly what those wait stats are. And you can see that there's a dip in the number of batches that are being performed, the number of key lookups suddenly spiked. Wow, what happened inside a SQL Server? You know, just at a glance, we know that there's a correlation. It's not something outside of SQL Server somewhere on Windows. It's in SQL Server. And then we can actually say, what's the smoking gun? What is it that's causing this particular problem? So we could drill right to the top SQL statements, and for that particular period of time, we could see exactly what was happening for that SQL server. We could see, we could even take a look at, the execution plan for that. And on top of that, any of the different things that have happened inside of SQL Server, we can alert on. So here we're looking at the execution plan. I want this to fit entirely in my window here. Not sure if you could see that, but it's kind of neat. Maybe I want it to, I'm going to auto-fit that again. Maybe I need to look at this in a different format than normal, so I'm going to flip this around. And so now I can drill in and look at my, look at my different views in different ways to find out what the different problems are, the SQL level problems. So I get instant correlation all the way down to the SQL statements that are causing these problems.
So Kevin, it's very cool, but I have to say you've rendered my collection, my extraordinary collection of scripts useless.
Right.
Now I can no longer boast that, look at my SQL toolkit.
Right.
And nobody else has this.
Yeah, so let's hop back over to the slide deck here. All right, now, on top of the monitoring requirements, we need to see everything that's happening inside a SQL server. We also have these very, very rigorous requirements for availability. This is a system that they're making millions of dollars, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars a year on. So every hour that it's down, it's like more than all of our salary put together, right? It's incredibly valuable. We got to keep this thing running all the time, day and night. And once again, it's the kind of thing where we have this whole stack of stuff that we have to worry about, we have to keep alive. And the key architectural requirement there was we got to have full redundancy on every level. SQL Server, OS, CPU, NIC, HBA, all the way through, top to bottom in that stack. We have to have shared nothing. Now, the way to do that, well, there's a lot of different ways to do it.
But before that, why shared nothing? How is shared nothing related with high availability? Why did the bank ask for that?
It sounds really cool. Shared nothing.
Right.
Well, we can't share. If we share anything and that one part breaks, then the whole system comes down. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So this is the, I'm a movie buff, so. Star Trek fans, raise your hands. Wow, make it so. So I'm sure that the Enterprise, although it looks pretty cool, but the saucer section is actually detachable. And I don't know if you know this, but in a few of those episodes, they were able to detach the saucer, and they could actually fly the saucer completely independent of the main body of the ship. So that's what shared nothing means. When you have shared nothing, that means you don't have any dependency. And you want to design your components so that they all can function in a self-sufficient manner. So think about shared storage. A lot of people feel comfortable with having a cluster. Say, oh, wow, look, I have a cluster. I have a four-way cluster or a six-way cluster. But at the end of the day, it's all pointing to shared storage. At the end of the day, there is a single set of data files and log files. So what does that mean? What if there is block-level corruption? I'm sure you have heard of that.
It means my saucer needs to detach?
Right, but it can't.
All right, sorry about that. I'm confused. All right, what does it mean? We've got block-level corruption. We're sharing that between two boxes.
So how do you recover from that? It doesn't really help to have multiple nodes because you still had your single set of data files and log files.
Right. Okay.
So either you have to restore from backup, which means you're going to lose some data, or you will have to run a DBCC check DB command with,
right.
I think it's called, the option is actually pretty scary. It actually is, I think, allow data loss
data loss.
And that is exactly what it means, because it is going to fix your database, but in the process, it will lose some data. And God knows what the data is. You don't know what the data will be lost.
Well, it might be good if it kept the boss away for a while, if he's at the ATM and he's trying to do a transaction there, right?
Right, exactly.
No, I think he would be unhappy with me if I let that happen.
So, there you go. Continue. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, no. So, we detach the saucer, and we have a... sorry, I've never seen that episode, so it just sounds kind of funny to me, detaching the saucer. What we do here in this case, if you've ever used log shipping or replication or, you know, maybe clustering, it's a little different. We designate a primary group in the availability group of always-on feature set. And from that, we can declare secondaries. We can configure secondaries to be local and synchronous so that the transactions, you know, actually report that they've completed and comes back to the primary, lets it know about that. Or they can be asynchronous where we don't wait for that to return with a confirmation. Between perhaps a secondary geographically distant location, so we want to protect against natural disasters or anything like that. And there are other things we can do to make that even more robust. For example, we can use different quorum models with these to vote on how these failovers happen. So whenever we have some kind of failure, we could use a file share kind of node for the quorum, or we could use a traditional node majority quorum model inside of the availability group. And this is an outstanding way. It's a big feature boost over what you get with, say, database mirroring, because you can do all kinds of things that you couldn't do with database mirroring before. For example, we can offload a large amount of work that we had to do on the primary before. Now we can take away certain things, like maybe we want to do a logic check, just the logic aspect of a DBCC check. Maybe we want to do all of our backups from the secondary. So now our preventative maintenance windows are much, much more robust and much more targeted. We don't have to do the backups off of that main server, the primary server. We don't have to do the reporting off of that primary server. And so we can move those workloads off. So let me show you a little bit about this as well in the system. One of the things about Always On that is nice is that you do get some pretty good tools right out of the box. We can see what our configuration looks like. You know, we can see whether there's data loss or, you know, how its status is at the moment, whether it's synchronizing or not. In the upper right-hand corner, there's a little wizard. You can see it says Start Failover Wizard, so we can move it from the primary to a secondary. But that's all about failures, fixing Kevin. Failures, things like that.
Kevin.
Yes.
So this interface, it looks good if you have 10 databases or 20 databases. But I'm willing to bet, as our customer has hundreds and thousands of databases, people will spend more time just scrolling their wheel mouse as opposed to doing anything.
Right. Down and down through the list to find out where there's a problem, down through the list. So again, this was another area where we partnered to produce some really interesting new innovative features here. So let me pipe over here. So one of the things that we provide now is we can look at the always-on management for a particular environment. And I'm going to have to move quickly because we don't have a whole lot of time left. But let's say we have a few particular SQL servers in availability groups. Make these a little bit bigger. For one thing, let's say I've got hundreds of SQL servers that are having a problem. Or maybe they're working great, but I want to tell just instantaneously how they're working. We could use this zoom to node, and we can see the entire network, all of these together at one time. Any of this that's red, we could then flip over and actually start to do some remediation on, like we saw over here in this matrix. So again, I'll zoom back in. So now at an instance, I as a DBA can look across hundreds, thousands of SQL servers and just follow the red trail. And there, boom, I'm right to the server that's got a problem. Now, let me actually kick off a little bit of work here as well. So you can see, let's see here. Nope. So now we're going to actually create some work. And it's going to take a little bit of time as it processes and as it pulls to collect the information on these different nodes. But what we have happening is transactions are occurring on the primary, and as they percolate along, it's pushing that data out to all of the secondary servers out there. And you can see on group C, on the right-hand side on that secondary, there's a red bar now. Left is reads. Reads and writes. So now we have a write alarm going off on the secondary SQL 4, right? And we can see some other alarms starting to happen in other locations here. So we can see that it's backing up, basically, right? One of the things that's really cool about this set of features is that the native tools, the way the tools automatically work, is that they're going to fail over for you automatically whenever there's a failure. But what we can do for you here in this set of tooling is we can cause an automatic failover on a performance issue so that when things start to get bottlenecked like this, boom, how would you like to be able to fail over to your secondary server now to take care of an I/O throttle, right? An I/O bottleneck. So you can't do that natively. You can't do that naturally. This is something that these tools will support for you, right? So let's go ahead and do that. Now, this might take a minute, too, to flip this over, but we're going to go ahead and move this to another instance. And, you know, so what it's going to do is it's going to go over to the other node. It's going to create those databases. It's going to instantiate them. It's going to build them. It's going to start to populate them with the data. And in a situation like that, if you're running on those spinning spindles, that's going to take a long time, right?
So, Kevin, what is, in fact, driving the secondary SQL Server here? What sort of storage is driving the SQL 4 instance, say, compared to others?
The SQL 4, I believe, is the commodity SSD that we had shown a little bit ago with the TPC benchmark there. So this is pretty fast. It's a lot faster than hard disks would be, but it's nowhere near what we get on the Fusion I/O side. And it's interesting to note, it hasn't actually started to move this data over, but you see it did flip over right there, over to the new server. And if this was hard disks, if we were going to fail it back over, you see I have a job here to revert it back over to SQL 4, it's going to take a lot longer to do that because one of the most time-consuming parts of all of that is instantiating the database. And because this is super high speed, the Fusion I/O disk, that instantiation happens almost instantly. So it's going to take a few minutes, a few seconds, and as it begins to get caught up in terms of creating those databases, building the schema, and applying those transactions, you're going to see that line turn green as well. There, start moving those transactions over. So now we've gone from a situation where the only way we could easily do failovers is if something broke. Now we can actually do it just because we know from our alerting that things are getting slow. And we can actually spread that workload out in a way that was not really possible for us to do, easily at least, in other circumstances. All right, well, we're out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and go past this rather than us wait for it to catch up. But it polls every couple seconds, so it will catch this in just a few moments and turn this back. And again, we could revert right back over to the SQL 4 instance as well. So that's how we did it, right? We had this whole huge stack full of different things that my little brain cannot understand. I can't even hardly multiply 16 times 16 to get a real. Anybody else have a problem with multiplication here? Okay, it's just me. That's what you're saying. All right. And so what do we wind up with?
Well, that looks nice to me.
Yeah.
Simple enough.
Keep it simple, right? The KISS principle. So we went from multiple components all over the place, not to mention all the different things in SQL that we were having to use in the native toolkit for that instrumentation, and now we went down to basically four components. Right?
So Kevin, I have a question. So this looks very simple, but you know, obviously the bank, it's a bank. They have all kinds of workloads. They have OLTP workloads. They have data warehousing workloads because they want to do a lot of analytics. So to tackle those different kinds of workloads, do they need to configure the I/O drive solutions or SQL Sentry solutions any different? As typically, you know, one is required when they have storage arrays and SANs.
That's one of the beauties of this, is that it's almost plug and play, right?
Nice. I like that.
I like that, yeah. I don't have to tweak the HBA driver apart from all the other kinds of drivers in that whole stack of everything on that left-hand side there. Yeah.
Nice.
So A lot of content, a lot of information, a lot of those slides we went past kind of quickly. If you want to go back and get that information, or you want to read more about the different source findings that we collated, take a look at the work by Thomas Kaiser, formerly with Microsoft on the SQL Customer Advisory Team. These are like the Jedi Knight Ninja Warriors of the customer service group at Microsoft. And some fantastic information from Thomas, who is now, I believe,
yes,
with you guys.
With Fusion.io.
Yeah, excellent. Also, with SQL Skills, Jonathan Caius has written some fantastic stuff around extended events. He's got some work in CodePlex that's really useful. Joe Sack, who's also speaking here. Joe has done some really, really good stuff around Always On. Well, a lot of great stuff, but that's one thing I wanted to draw your attention to. We mentioned Paul's stuff earlier on when we showed you the graph of performance on that 160 gigabyte database. And then also some more stuff on a website called SQLperformance.com, which I'd like to draw your attention to, around a really neat set of information about what is the overhead for all these different ways of monitoring SQL Server, extended events versus trace versus perfmon and so forth. So lots of good information in there. So let's wrap it up.
So what did we learn? Well, if you want high performance, no point in building out huge infrastructures, complex infrastructures with large topologies. Just dial up your good old friend, IO Memory from Fusion.io. It's as simple as that.
Outstanding, yeah. And similarly, you want transparency, you want visibility, you want instrumentation. It's really hard with the native tools. You can make a lot of it work, but it's so much easier, so much less maintenance, so much less intensity on your part when you use Performance Advisor from SQL Sentry. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Great point. Thanks, Kimberly. Yeah, so come on down to our booth. Take a look at it. We are actually, coincidentally, next to each other. And so if you want to take a look at it, it's right there.
Yeah. At some point in time, we have to find a way to separate. But
Indeed. So I was really impressed that we could solve this for the customer. I didn't have a lot of confidence in myself, to be honest with you.
Kevin, can I shake your hand?
Oh, thank you very much.
You know, I have a whole new respect for you. I think your software suite is excellent because I just felt that with so many databases, no matter what we do, at the end of the day, their DBAs will be just scrolling left and right, up and down.
When he says he has so much more respect for me, that means when you go from 0 to, 10, it's much easier to go to that than it is from 10 to 100. I'm sorry. Anyway, all right. So with that, folks.
No comeback on that one.
Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. We know you have a lot to do. And so we're very appreciative that you came and spent this hour with us. And so we hope to see you at the booths. If you have any questions, our information is in the program. So we hope to talk with you as well throughout the event. Thank you very much, folks.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming.